Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And joining us in the first part of the show today are a couple of folks from Purple Air. They're Amanda Hawkins and the founder and owner, Adrian Dibwad. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Hello.
Thank you. Hello.
Thanks for joining us this morning. So, Adrian, let's start with you and why you started this company. What was your motivation to do this?
We live on the point of the mountain near the gravel pit, and we would watch dust blowing over Bluffdale every day. And I just wondered how much dust there really was. And I said to myself, it's 2015. There must be a sensor that we can find and put together. And having an internet and computer background, I set about making a sensor.
So there wasn't already one out there that you could find, you know, on a quick search online to purchase
right.
and install.
So something that reported to the internet that measured dust particles mm-hmm. was not, they were very expensive,
yeah.
mm-hmm. tens of thousands of dollars. And so making your own was pretty much the only option.
So it started with a concern right at home for you and your family.
Yes.
All right. So how does this sensor work? Because actually we have one, a couple in studio, and we're even going to attempt to collect some air quality data in here while
yes,
we're talking.
The air is actually good in this studio right now. It's green.
It's
all right.
Green.
We're
yep.
happy to
it's,
report
okay.
that. Have you've got
so,
a glowing
so far,
green over
so
here.
So far, it's good.
yes.
But how does this? Let's describe for our listeners what, and if they want to while they listen, they can go to the website and see it. Purpleair.com. Okay.
There is a link at the top that says map, and you can click on that, and you can see all the sensors throughout the world. The sensor is about 2-inch in diameter. It's actually a 2-inch PVC end cap.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to
That's
exactly
what,
that's what
it looks
say.
Like, huh? Yeah.
The first version was built with parts from Home Depot. I just went there and bought a bunch of stuff to try to figure out how to make it. And the PVC end cap has stayed with us because it's really effective. It's very tough. It can stay outside in the sun for weeks and months and
right.
years without anything happening to it. And it provides a rain and moisture type of protection to the sensor. It's very simple. You just screw it onto the side of the wall of your house or tie it on with a cable tie somewhere onto right. a downpipe or a pole or something.
Right.
And you connect it to power and you connect it to your Wi-Fi network and it reports data to the website.
So, talk a little bit more about how above and beyond just giving you data about the air quality at your own home, how it kind of links to the rest of this network. Talk about the map.
Right. So in the beginning, it was like we can put a sensor down below in Bluffdale, but then why don't we just put them throughout the rest of the valley? And I made some to do that. We gave them away in the beginning. We found people on Facebook who were willing to host them. And then more and more people got interested. We made a few more. We probably made about 80 in that first phase. And then we sent some for testing down with the South Coast Air Quality Management District's AQ Spec program where they test low quality sensors.
That's in California.
That's in California.
Yeah.
It's a government regulator down there. And the results came back from that test were the results were very good. 97% correlation with the federal equivalent methods, which is the expensive sensors. And after that, people really started taking an interest. Universities, different groups that would maybe buy a couple of them, and then they would study them themselves, compare them to their own sensors, and do their own studies. And we've had multiple confirmations of the results of the South Coast study. So that really drove people's interest. And then the other thing about it is the desire to share the data. So that's why the map, you can just look, see it immediately. The real focus is on letting people for free without a logon, without paying anything, to be able to get to the data,
mm-hmm.
to use it to make decisions whether they go cycling or where they go cycling. Or some people use it with asthmatic kids where they will decide when they should go outside or to the park or whatever.
So let's spend a little bit of time talking about the science behind this. This is reading particulate matter, 2.5, PM 2.5. We're all familiar enough. Our listeners know PM 2.5, PM 10, particulate matter. How's it doing that?
So PM 2.5 is particles of an average size of 2.5 microns, up to 2.5 microns in size. And it uses a laser to shine light onto the air that's passing the laser beam. And then the particles in the air will reflect that light into a detector. And that detector uses some pretty nifty software that will count the number of particles, and also it characterizes their size. So it'll estimate the size, and it'll count those flashes that it's getting, and then it does an estimation of the micrograms per meter cubed value, right. Which is trying to convert it into what the regular sensors, sort of the older devices use, the format that they use to present the data.
Right. Okay. And then, you know, we're accustomed to air quality standards down in Salt Lake City being degraded during the winter, and we hear all about air quality reports. And then they're kind of given a color code. So it matches that, too.
Yes.
So people who are already familiar with the color code system, the numbering system associated with air quality reports, is exactly the data you're providing.
Yes. So the map also presents it in other ways.
Yeah.
We use the AQI scale. We use the raw values that we're sensing. We use the AQHI scale, which is the Canadian standards.
Wow.
We use another one called the Village Green, which is developed by the EPA for low-cost sensors. And a couple of other types of, you know, you can see the raw data in lots of different ways.
Right.
So the intention with that is that, you know, you can really view it in different ways to, you know, if you understand it in one way or another. And the other thing to realize is that counting particles, you're using an average mass, and you're converting that to a micrograms per meter cubed. And so there sometimes can be a discrepancy with what these measure because of that calculation.
Mm.
You're assuming a density of the particles that you're measuring, whereas in reality they have a particular density. If you're using a gravimetric, what's called a gravimetric sensor, which the EPA would use, they suck air through a filter and then they weigh the filter.
Yes.
So they're actually measuring the weight of the particles, whereas we're counting them and then converting that into a mass. And so sometimes we'll read high, sometimes we'll read low. Wildfire smoke has a different average density to gravel dust or other types of pollution. So that's what can make some kind of differences. People will make a comment of that they tend to read a bit high sometimes, which can be the case because of those kinds of factors.
But that equipment that you talk about, the gravimetric system, that's the one that can be very expensive and time-consuming and maybe not give you real-time data.
Right. The sensor itself costs $30,000 to $60,000.
Yeah.
And the DAQ will run a site that costs them about $250,000 a year just to run that site. Because you have to also calibrate those devices. You have to have them staffed by experienced individuals.
Right.
So these outdoor sensors are shared on the map. Is the indoor data also shared, or is that private, I guess?
Yeah, the user has the choice to share the indoor data. And some people will say, well, why should I share my indoor data? And and our response to that is, well, if you don't share your indoor data, how do you know what other people are, where they are compared to you? If you can see someone else's indoor air quality, you can then look at your own and say, okay, well, I'm good compared to that one, or I'm bad compared to this other one. And so sharing the indoor data is very useful for that purpose. And it also serves another purpose. If you look at the wildfires in California last year, you can see who's doing well with indoor filtering. And you can also then see what you can strive for, what you can attain, because the outdoor air quality was horrendous. These certain indoor sensors were reading green or yellow or something, and yours is reading red. You can think, okay, I need to get a better filter, or it's possible to achieve those kinds of levels.
Yeah, I can see businesses maybe wanting to do this too for health and safety reasons, OSHA requirements, et cetera.
Right. Down in California, there's actually a new law about wildfire smoke and your employees. And so we have had inquiries from companies down there talking about that and wanting to start measuring air quality around their buildings for that very purpose.
Let me reintroduce you. If you just join us, we're speaking with Adrien Duvaud. He is the owner and founder of Purple Air. Also, Amanda Hawkins, who works with Purple Air, and we're talking about their product, their air quality monitoring system, particulate matter, in particular, and the reasonability of it too.
Yeah.
We'll get to
so
that.
So practical.
Yeah, practical.
One other kind of neat feature of these sensors is looking at the maps here. It seems like you have all these, you know, air quality measurements you can look at, but you can also switch it to a temperature map in Fahrenheit or Celsius. You can also look at humidity. So you're also getting a little bit of other data about the conditions around the sensor.
Yes. So because in the beginning there was a question about humidity's effect on the particles, and humidity can make the particles seem bigger. And so when you're counting them, you're overestimating them even more due to humidity. we decided to put a temperature and humidity sensor on every device so that we could keep track of humidity. If it was important to convert values okay. based on humidity, that we would be able to do that. So that information provides a bit of extra usefulness. It is skewed because the sensor itself is not a proper Stevenson screen. It gets a bit warm from the Wi-Fi module inside there. Ah. And so the humidity is a little bit low and the temperature is a little bit elevated. But there's like a generalization that we can do to convert it to make it useful. So on the map, we've included that data with that generalization correction factor. We've also included something that's a bit of fun called the Humidex, which is an indication of how comfortable it might feel. It's a value based on a calculation that the Canadians invented that uses the temperature and humidity to give you an idea of what comfort level you should experience. So you can view the map in the Humidex format, and you can see where it's going to be more comfortable, less comfortable to exist.
Nell, are you looking at the map?
I am looking at the map.
Is there any bad air?
And I'm
there?
Looking at the Humidex right okay, now. Okay. The air quality did look pretty good. Everything was pretty much green. So now I'm checking at the Humidex, and we're all kind of this light bluish teal. Yeah. And so that means we're very comfortable, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And this is in the Park City area?
I would agree with that.
There's several in the Park City area?
Yeah, in Kimball Junction, into town here as well, out by Summit Park in Pine Brook.
And can you get specific data? You can go click on that and get specific data from there?
Yes.
Okay. So these are either residents or businesses that have installed these systems.
Correct.
Okay. Where is it? Let's talk about where's a good place to install it? I mean, if you're looking for, again, this is particulate matter. Is there recommended heights and locations?
We don't have any too strict guidelines on that. We leave it up to the individual. Our advice would be to put it somewhere that is convenient. We don't want you to be climbing up tall ladders and trying to get it up to, because inevitably you're going to do that, and then something's going to happen with your Wi-Fi or the power is going to, so you're going to have to access the sensor. So we encourage people to mount it where it's convenient, if possible under the eave of the roof of the house so it's in the shade. That's not completely necessary, though. It will just mean your temperature will be affected by sunlight if it's not.
Right.
And it's really about convenience. It should be near an outlet. It should be within range of your Wi-Fi, and also hopefully away from vents like dryer vents or your AC vents or something
point
like that.
Point sources, right? Although those are the sources of particulate matter, you don't want to stick it right next to it. You want to give it some distance.
Right, and also people say things like, well, what about barbecues and stuff? And you don't use your barbecue all the time. You use it for a short period of time, and you get used to seeing someone's barbecue on the map too, because you see, okay, well, this is really bad air quality and it's only just a temporary thing, and then that spike will disappear and the averages pretty quickly too.
Oh, how funny.
And also really the intention of this is to measure what you're experiencing. This is the whole point of the network.
Here's where I see a lot of value is areas where there's idling going on, parking lots, drive-throughs, things like that, and school pickup zones, drop-off and pickup zones, where there's a lot of idling vehicles, particularly in the winter. That's where our PM levels will spike. Again, maybe over 8-hour averages and times they're fine, but in some of those situations, you're looking for real-time information, if only to collect that data and get an understanding of what potential health effects there are with respect to PM levels.
Right. And, the thing that's also in the beginning was like a myth. It would be said that the air quality is even along the Wasatch Front, that it's uniform. And we're finding that that's really not the case. Mm. There are local hotspots, there are areas, and also the pollution can clear up very quickly. It can come in very quickly. So mm-hmm. within minutes, you can be good. And then you're relying on a sensor that's 20 miles away, that's lower than you, that's in a completely different environment. It just didn't really follow. That's why the other thing, we were in North Carolina recently with the EPA, and one summary at the end of that meeting was that the purpose of the monitoring needs to be clear. So the government sensors, the EPA sensors, their mission is to enforce regulations and laws. They're called regulatory monitors, and they're meant to be regional and citywide. So they'll have a sensor placed in the city, and they will monitor averages that are hourly, 24-hour yearly averages, to enforce rules. But you can't use that same sensor to determine whether you should go cycling now or not, because that's really now in real time.
Right.
So people want real-time data. This is what this network provides. It's real-time data, and it's not meant to be used for regulatory purposes. That's what the EPA sensors are for.
Okay.
And so it's important to remember that too. But the other thing to do with idling-free zones, for instance, is that if you have the wind in one direction and you're measuring upwind,
yes,
you're not going to pick it up.
Yeah.
If you have two sensors or three sensors around the area, now you're more likely to maybe pick it up. It's like a campfire. When you're standing downwind, you know all about it, and you're going to move pretty quickly. And the wind changes, and you move again. That's where you might see spikes from time to time.
That's an interesting experiment. That's why I see these things being of value at schools as educational tools. Let the science teachers incorporate these monitors in their into their classroom.
And look, we do get a lot of emails from teachers and
who are interested in
that. Yes.
And these, let's real quick, and I'll get back to you. What are these costs? There's three different systems. Tell them.
So the main outdoor unit is $229. We do have an indoor that we just put on our website.
Yeah.
And that's at $179. And we also have another outdoor unit that has the SD card in it. And they use those for if they don't have Wi-Fi signal, you can get the one with the SD card, and you would have to take that card out, plug it into your computer, and read it.
Okay.
So you have that option, and those are at
$159.
Okay.
We're giving a special discount on the screen here today.
But you know, that's for the price compared to, like you were saying, a more formal, robust equipment that costs tens of thousands of dollars and may not even give real-time data. This is a great tool to get, again, some relatively instantaneous, maybe it's qualified in some ways, like you say, but it's still data that is important to get a sense of environmental conditions that otherwise we're just guessing.
Absolutely. And, you know, the EPA sensors, those are highly fine-tuned instruments. They're calibrated from time to time. They are expensive. And there's only one or two of them in areas.
Yeah.
Whereas we have hundreds. So the difference between ours is that we just have a large number.
Yes.
And then that enables you to see the good and the bad ones. If you see one that's reading high, you can be sure either that someone's barbecue, or you can just ignore it because it's got an insect inside it or something like that. So you look at the network and you base it on the total number that you're seeing reading something. If there's 100 in an area reading high, you can be assured that you're going to be seeing haze.
So give us a sense of how many you have out there. Yeah. And it's not just in the U.S. This is around the world, as you mentioned.
Yeah, we've got over 5,000 on the network now.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's all mapped in one, you know, yes. Generally.
Yes.
Do they work just in stationary sources, or can they be put on a moving line source like a bus or a train or something like that?
Yeah,
or is that too complicated?
It's something that we get asked from time to time. Do you have a portable sensor? And
it's
really
carried around.
Yeah, I see less usefulness. I mean, we want to measure for a long duration of time. And if you had to carry something with you, it's another thing you have to keep charged. So you're probably going to give that up after a couple of weeks. Whereas if you put it on the side of your house, you plug it into power, it just monitors 24/7. Days and weeks on end. And that's what is important.
Yeah.
If you're measuring it and you're doing a drive into town, okay, you've got data for that snapshot for that drive, but then your sensor's not used for the rest of the day.
Right.
So to me, we focused on fixed locations because I see the most value in those.
Are you know, you'd mentioned universities and researchers had been contacting you. Have people started picking this data up yet? Are they using it in research at this point?
Absolutely. You mentioned school projects as well, like measuring air quality around no idling zones. School kids, there's quite a few projects that they've done using the data or getting sensors. And also university students, lots of people have done studies for their thesis or something on it. We provide a way for you to access the data. You can download all the data in the data set if you wanted. It's really, I think we're on nearly 2 billion records now. It's a lot of data.
That's a lot of data management.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so if anyone that wants to download the data, you can get, you can email us and we'll send you information on how you access it. And we have a lot of people that have done studies on it.
Is there much maintenance required? Handle and care of it?
No, the maintenance is pretty much hands off. There's nothing that the user can do. There's nothing that can be calibrated on it. If something goes wrong with the sensor, we generally would replace it or replace the laser counters. And the other thing worth mentioning to do with maintenance is that we have two laser counters in each sensor.
Mm.
The reason for that is that you can tell if they agree with each other that the sensor's good. Being outdoors, quite often the sensors, or not quite often, I guess it actually doesn't happen all that often, is things get inside. Spiders or debris, seeds that are floating around in there get sucked in there. Mm. And if that gets into the laser beam, then it makes it read haywire values. And it's unlikely that both laser counters are going to have that happen at the same time.
And, say, extreme cold conditions?
We have them operating in Alaska, for instance, where it's so cold that if you interfere with the power cable, it'll crack it and fall in dust on the floor.
Right.
So, they operate in all sorts of conditions. We have people that have used them in Alaska and British Columbia for quite some time now. Sometimes if it's really, really cold, they might get ice particles inside them, but it's not a big problem.
Okay.
And the setup seems really easy. So yes, we have one going here in the studio, and all I did was plug it into the power. Is there anything else? You know, what would a setup look like at home?
Right. So the indoor one, like we've got here, has got an LED on it that gives you a color based on the AQI, so you can just glance at it and see it, so you don't have to do anything more. But if you wanted to report to the website, then you would connect to it from your computer, and you would configure it to connect to your Wi-Fi. So that's another step that you would have to do. The outdoor one is very similar. So you would plug it into power. You would then connect your computer to it, tell the sensor how to connect to Wi-Fi, generally giving it your network name and password, and it would then connect to your Wi-Fi and continue on its own.
Very straightforward.
I think this is a device that, one of these things like you, Adrian, he's like, wow, why isn't there something out there like this that we can get real-time data on important pieces of air quality issues. And up here, you know, during the winter, that's our most vulnerable time too, as well as, say, Salt Lake City, you know, with a lot of fireplaces going, and that's fine. But that's when our air quality is most, in particulate matter, that's when our air quality is most noticeable. I'd like to install one underneath the eaves of my neighbor when he idles his truck every morning for 20 minutes, and see what the air quality. I'm gonna just put one on my garage near it, and I can get that information.
Yeah,
and again, that's data to take to somebody to say, this is why we have a new idling policy in this town. It's compelling data.
It helps you see the invisible.
Okay, well, in some cases, it's. You know, it's visible in some cases. Observable.
Sure.
but it's numbers.
Yes.
And it's backed by science.
And it also helps you monitor it while you're not there. I mean, if you're not there to see it, you can still monitor it. Like at night in the darkness here in Salt Lake City, you know, you can't see the pollution.
So good point.
Is it there? Is it gone?
Right.
You know, this really, it lets people experiment. It lets you try different things. And we're really heartened by the response. It's been incredible.
Well, we're glad you took the time to come up and chat with us. It's really interesting. Again, the website, purpleair.com.
That's it.
Simple. And go from there. It's a great website. And the data, you can just go on there, too, and visit the data.
You can click on individual sites. You can zoom in and out. You can see several days of data.
Wow.
I've been distracted during the interview because I've been fiddling with your map.
And where you're going to put one at Swanner?
Yeah. I have a long list.
You got it. Well, like Adrian said, one's not enough. You're going to have to buy four or five. That is a little salesman pitch.
Right.
You got to cover all the upwind, downwind conditions.
That's right.
We have people that tell us that it's the first thing they do in the morning is they check the map.
It's,
you know.
Okay.
I'm sure. I'm quickly becoming addicted here.
Okay.
So.
Well, Adrian Duvaud and Amanda Hawkins with Purple Air, thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you
we'll
for having us.
We'll stay in touch. All right.